From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. We live in a country where mass shootings are so common, they follow a script. Horror and tears, vows for action, and then silence until the next shooting. There are more guns in the U.S. today than people. And indeed, guns appear to be better protected than actual living human beings. The Second Amendment is recited like prayer by gun proliferation activists who see it as justification for any and all gun violence. Now in a new book called Loaded, author Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz explores the history of the Second Amendment and makes the case that guns have historically been part of the American genocide of Native American communities and a tool for enforcing slavery. In other words, gun culture is deeply intertwined with the nation's racist history. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz is a historian, author, memoirist, and speaker. Her 1977 book, The Great Sioux Nation, was a fundamental document at the first United Nations Conference on Indians in the Americas, which was held at the UN headquarters in Geneva. Her other books include Outlaw Woman and the acclaimed An Indigenous People's History of the United States. She now joins me to discuss her newest book, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. Welcome to the program, Roxanne.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. I loved that you started this book with a story about how you got sucked into gun love, as you call it, because there have historically been groups on the left who have resorted to arming themselves for self-defense in the 1960s and 70s in particular. This became true today. There are some groups who still speak to that. So tell us that story in a way to illustrate the relationship that those who are very strong proponents of guns today, gun rights, have the same sort of feeling, this kind of paranoia that and a deep, really, love for their guns.
Yeah, I tell the story more in detail in the book you mentioned, Outlaw Woman, which is my history of the 60s activities. And so there's a chapter on the guns, the gun period, which was about 1970 to 72 for me and my group. We were based in New Orleans, working out of the South, and we were mainly a women's group. I sort of, you know, I call us a study group. We sort of were that, but we were an activist group. Women's liberation, but also anti-imperialist, anti-racist. Some of us had just been to Cuba in the Venceremos Brigade. So we're quite radical. And although New Orleans had, you know, really strong civil rights movement that was still active, it was also a very racially caste place with a good deal of anti-Black racism, but in general also anti-leftist, that anti-communist, you know, like throughout the South, completely merging anti-communism and any kind of social movements. So there's also the Ku Klux Klan was really getting active again throughout the South, and a young David Duke, who's still very active in the 40, almost 50 years later, still very active and still in Louisiana. He was the head of the Ku Klux Klan locally and very open about it, interviewed a lot. He's a, you know, blonde, good-looking young guy. And he started calling and threatening us that we shouldn't be in New Orleans, that we were anti-American. We had come back from Cuba and given interviews to the newspaper and had public meetings. You know, we weren't secretive in any way, very out front with everything. But it was a period of time when the Weather Underground was about, it was forming other groups in the Northwest. And of course, there was the Black Panther Party that was turning into the Black Liberation Army. So many people were incarcerated and they had to go to prison to avoid going to prison. The only thing possible was to go underground. So this was, you know, we weren't just an isolated phenomenon by any means. Although we, our group was Marxist tendency, and we didn't think that the kind, at first, we didn't think that the kind of uprisings taking place in Uruguay, the Tupamaros, on Argentina, and really throughout Latin America, and based on the kind of Che model, that it was really fitting for the United States, at least at that point in time. So we actually armed ourselves for self-defense. I mean, that was really the reason, because we really thought we were threatened.
Did that experience help you sort of in researching this book, where today you have this very, very strong gun culture in the United States that a very, significant percentage of the American population feels that no amount of bloodshed at the hands of guns and gun wielders is worth undermining the Second Amendment?
Yeah, it's, it's considered, I go through the whole history, of course, in the book, mm-hmm. of the white nationalist, white supremacist roots of the Second Amendment being included in the Constitution as an individual right. For settlers to take the land of Native people, which they had been doing, as in the colonies for over almost 200 years, slave patrols, actually citizen slave patrols, to control enslaved Africans. And those were then carved out of the militias as the militias became unnecessary in the East Coast. They appeared, though, throughout the Hundred Years' War, I call it, up to 1890, in taking the continent. So these were, the militias, the state militias, the official state militias, that we now call National Guard, they were actually provided for in the Constitution itself structurally. So this is something that people miss sometimes with the Second Amendment, that it is, the Bill of Rights is a list of individual rights that were added to the Constitution, which was really about institutional structures and relationships and the powers of government and the divisions of power. And the electoral system, all of which was very stacked, of course, and oligarchic and all white. But the Second Amendment was the Second Amendment right after, freedom of speech, right there with freedom of religion. And it wasn't even argued about. There's no argument about it. It already had been put into the state constitutions. After the Declaration of Independence, each of the colonies, the 13 colonies, became autonomous states, independent states. So what the Constitution did was create a federalism of those states. The states still had a lot of autonomy, and all those states by 1777 had, especially the slave states, had already included in their state constitutions the right to bear arms as an individual.
So the well-regulated militias that the Second Amendment refers to were essentially these state militias that helped to further the project of Manifest Destiny in removing Native Americans from their land, and to, in particular, be these slave patrols. So essentially, the state militias, you write, evolved into the state's National Guard.
That's what I'm explaining. The state militias were provided for in the Constitution. That was something completely separate. That was to, fight off foreign enemies, and whatever the National Guard used for now is what state militias were used for. So it was a state organized, but the well-organized militia in the Second Amendment are the citizens' militias, unpaid, voluntary citizens' militias, like Andrew Jackson's Tennessee militia. And it did give the right of settlers to kill Indians, take their land, and then even call the army in or the Marines to help them once they were besieged by the Indian resistance, and also to be organized to, in the 1690s is when slave patrols came to the colonies in North America from Barbados, with the South Carolina Barbados people coming up and creating South Carolina. And they already had slave patrols in Barbados, and they brought them. So they carved those out of these voluntary militias. But these were individual rights. It's very important to understand that, because the liberal argument is that they were individual rights. And the Bill of Rights is the Bill of Individual Rights. That's what it exists for. So that's a really important factor, that to understand populist white nationalism. And of course, I have a whole chapter on white nationalism and that relationship. And if you realize that the average gun owner of the 300 million guns that exists actually own 8 guns. And
so the majority are in the hands of most guns are in the hands of a small number of people.
Yes, and 60% of those who own those guns, multiple guns, are white men. Hmm. And white men are nowhere near 60% of the population, and only half the white population.
So in some way, did the Second Amendment then essentially deputize every individual in the United States who had rights at that time to be part of the, you know, the enforcers of slavery?
Well, the enforcers of slavery, but also the taking of land, because who's going to do that? You know, the whole process from the beginning was settlers coming and settler colonialism. You know, it's a unique form of colonialism that really only exists in its pure form in the Anglo colonies of United States, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. And they all did the same things. The only thing about the other three, certainly their, you know, their genocidal taking of the land was exactly the same policies, the same behavior. But what they lacked was slavery. So that becomes extremely important in the exceptional nature of the United States as a state, as a settler state in the world. Because in Latin America, in the heavily slave colonies, in Cuba, in Dominican Republic, and in even the British colonies in Barbados, the Portuguese in Brazil, the slave population was always hugely more than the managerial population.
So they needed the guns to keep them in check, basically.
To prosper, in order to protect their property, you know, their property rights. Property was number one, but also with slavery, a part of real estate or a part of property was the African body, actually the African body. So it was the Indian land, the African body. Hmm. And that's such an important part of U.S. slavery, which really, I mean, auction blocks existed everywhere, but only in the United States. Only the United States was found as a capitalist state, number one, thanks to and Alexander Hamilton, who's being so feted these days, of, you know, bringing that theory of capitalism into the formation of a state. So where the slave body becomes a cash commodity, bought and sold eventually in the Cotton Kingdom with pieces of paper, and mortgages were given, loans were given based on not only from banks, but from U.S. banks, but from British and French. It was international. It was really international capitalism. That was created, the form of capitalism created that now dominates the world was created in the United States. and based on slave labor and slave bodies as commodities and real estate.
And guns were an inherent part of that project. You write in your book about the way in which historical figures that wielded guns and fomented gun violence have been romanticized as part of this project of gun culture in the United States. One among them is Jesse James. Tell us a little bit about how that history is distorted.
Well, of course, that's the, you know, the cowboys and Indians, the Westerns of the movie genre of Westerns, which is what actually U.S. cinema was built upon. It actually started in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and what was had been Indian Territory, that film business with these real people acting themselves, not Jesse James. He was dead by then, but the younger brothers and others of those gangs. And they were all Confederate guerrillas in Missouri. So they were the ones fighting the abolitionists, the ones that, you know, John Brown had his war with in Kansas, the Kansas-Missouri wars that went on for 10 years before the actual national, you know, Civil War, before the Confederacy existed. So these people were under this leader named Quantrill, who is a mercenary killer. These were killers, but they invented a unique style of call it ride-by shooting, you know, shooting up houses, shooting up families, using the new Colt, the six gun, you know, the revolver, and in both hands, riding, you know, without reins, and shooting. And this became the iconic cowboy. And so when Jesse James is now remembered, and I also tell about my own knowledge of the James gang and the younger brothers and these people who were Confederate guerrillas, that I didn't know that. We were told that in, you know, childhood stories, I actually thought they were still alive, that they were these wonderful bandits like Robin Hood, you know, stole from the rich and gave to the poor. And, you know, it's so important, you know, I go into it in some detail because of the absorption of that into the popular culture, including the left and, you know, you could say the counterculture of the 1960s with the famous when they drove Old Dixie down of the band, that Joan Baez and all these people who were anti-racist and involved in these things, who had not a clue, you know, that they're actually supporting guerrillas. And of course, Jesse James remains a kind of hero. T.J. Styles has written a wonderful biography of Jesse James, which was very useful to me. And, you know, making the clear case that Jesse James was a complete sociopath, you know, that these guerrillas were absolute killers. They not only killed, they mutilated bodies to terrify people. There weren't many slave owners, although they came from slave-owning families. They didn't have large-scale slavery in Missouri, but nevertheless, they, you know, five slaves, they're still, you know, they're still the elite of that particular place in Missouri. And this was truly about preserving slavery and white supremacy. So they're then recast as these, and you have Outlaw Josie Wales. He was another one, another Confederate guerrilla that Clint Eastwood made a film of his heroic fight against as a Confederate guerrilla and standing up to the U.S. government. So the Confederate story, you know, we have all these things about the monuments now, but not going into these narratives that are part of the popular culture, people don't really question I actually have gotten more negative feedback from people, you know, my comrades from the 1960s who loved the band and loved, you know, they drove Old Dixie Down, and of course Robbie Robertson, the great Mohawk movie music producer of all times, and also formed the band and wrote that song, you know, and he was Canadian. I mean, he could maybe be excused not understanding the history, but they, you know, wanted to defend, it's sort of like defending the racist white supremacist Walt Whitman as a poet. So there's this sort of popular culture that white nationalism is very deep. It's not just,
right.
You know,
some, so I want to jump quickly into this idea of the mythology of the hunter as a justification for gun proliferation in the United States. You know, the NRA often invokes, and a lot of gun rights activists invoke this idea that they, you know, this is recreational for them to have access to these guns, as if there was this, you know, really strong culture of hunting in the United States where people are catching and killing and eating their own game. I don't know how true that is, but how much of a myth is it?
Well, it's a complete myth. For one thing, they're playing Indian. They think that's how Indians live, and it doesn't at all reflect. You know, Indians didn't, you know, tromp around in the woods hunting. They trapped, and even the early fur traders like Daniel Boone. You know, these commercial hunters. They were all commercial hunters. They trapped, you know, trapped animals, and they. So this even the NRA started as a, you know, this idea of the hunter, and Theodore Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge, when Theodore Roosevelt was I can't remember which position he was in. He was governor of New York or whatever. But he's from the elite of New York, and Cabot Lodge, they actually formed the Boone and Crockett Rifle Club, which was for hunters, and he became a trophy hunter, you know, this urban, wealthy guy, Roosevelt, and got a ranch in South Dakota and played Indian and hated Indians as well, so wanted them all wiped out. So this... you know, this whole, the Second Amendment actually opens a window if people will allow themselves to look at the real history of the United States. They'll see a house of horrors when they open that window of all the implications of the Second Amendment.
And then how much of these myths fuel the rise of the contemporary rise of white nationalism and white supremacist thought today?
Well, I would estimate that, you know, a critical mass of all these guns are massed among, you know, ideological white nationalists. You know, I come from rural Oklahoma, so I'm not unfamiliar with, you know, I have some members of my family who are this. I grew up with this understanding of things and sort of, you know, taking it for granted, but I see it so woven into the culture now, and people like Arlie Hochschild's book, where she went and lived with poor white people in Louisiana and became very sympathetic to them and presents their point of view of how they're discriminated against. And what they're really saying, if she were listening and she were, you know, really not in denial about the history, is they're saying that the white race is being outnumbered. You know, and that they're fighting for survival and they're victims. And it's so, you know, and all of this is coming out. This is such a wonderful opportunity since we have to tolerate Donald Trump to come to understand some of these things, that it's not an anomaly. And he's not that much different than Theodore Roosevelt, or I say George Washington was the biggest real estate land speculator, a real estate man.
Wow.
We're back to ground zero, with a real estate man in power, but and a white nationalist, I mean, George Washington was a white nationalist. So I think we just have to come to terms with U.S. history, and at least on the left, I mean, it's not easy to organize with the truth.
Roxanne, we've talked about how guns and the right to bear arms is deeply embedded in the history of U.S. slavery and also the genocide of Native Americans. What about women and the subjugation of women? This is also a story that isn't told enough.
Well, it's also a story that's not told enough about the gun violence, because when they're counting, like school shootings, workplace shootings, just mass shootings for no reason at all, like Las Vegas, out of the, just shooting into crowds. These mass shootings, they actually, federal authorities, local police, the whole, the whole carceral community, they do not consider domestic violence is put in a whole different category. And I went through, I have a chapter on these mass killings that it's pretty, if you look at each of these mass killers where it's not a domestic, you separate that. But even if 10 people are killed, it doesn't get listed officially as a mass shooting if it's family members being killed. And that usually means a man killing a woman, his wife. And this is actually pre-woven into, this kind of misogyny into many of these mentally ill mass killers. They take up the, anyone who's on the edge mentally, something that is being promoted all the time, the gun violence and the mass killing, it takes form in that person's mind. And even if they're not ideological, but there's some of those killings, like the one in Killeen, Texas, in a restaurant, the man was yelling, bitches, hate all women. It was during the Anita Hill hearings, and he'd been raving about women taking over. And that was never really in the newspaper. I mean, it was in the newspapers, but it wasn't, I don't see it cited. My book, I didn't take it up because it's a very short book. The intertwining of patriarchy. I took it up a little bit. I mentioned it, but there needs to be a deep study of that root. We have the racist roots are very clear, but also the control of women, because of course women. The slave codes were based upon the control of women, on the property, male rights. And even under Roman law, which they tried to emulate, this is patriarchy. It was called patria. The family was called patria. And the women held the same position as the slaves in the family. So this is, there's just a lot of that was being done back in the 60s and I did some of it, of those kinds of studies of this interrelationship, but it's less so now. There's this kind of separation of
right.
fields.
And then Roxanne, we haven't talked about the NRA yet, but no conversation about guns would be complete without a brief mention of the NRA. At least a lot of folks want to believe that the NRA is the reason why, the sole reason why we simply cannot get enough good gun control legislation passed. From your study of the history of the Second Amendment, what do you make of that claim?
Well, the NRA started off in the early 20th century as a recreational, you know, a hunting and fishing kind of club, and it didn't really change. In fact, the NRA testified in the 1930s. The only time this Second Amendment gun control has even come up in the United States was during the Chicago criminal gangs, you know, during Prohibition, all shooting each other and using the Tommy gun, you know, the new Tommy gun, and the outlawing that weapon. An NRA representative was actually testified in favor of that law. So nothing really came up until the civil rights movement. So I think we have to see this new gun craze as and the change in the NRA. And it's very clear with the NRA that a group of definite white nationalists who had organized, you know, a separate organization, they invaded and took over and won control of the National Rifle Association in 1976, and I tell the story, and it's a well-known story. You know, it's not like it's a secret. I didn't do any deep research with this stuff. It's all out there, but it doesn't seem to get through, you know, to the public very much. That there was a takeover, and this was the rise of the, you know, with John Birch Society in the 1950s. That was, of course, there was always, you know, the Ku Klux Klan coming and going, but the John Birch Society was, this was like the Koch brothers were members when they were young, were members of the, and their father was a member of the John Birch Society, and it was a very vocal white nationalists, and it had a military arm, the Minutemen. So this was all to oppose the end of Jim Crow, the control of African Americans. And then, of course, the civil rights movement spawned Red Power movement, the Chicano movement, women's movement. Probably the anti-war movement wouldn't have been what it was, you know, without an already massively organized civil rights movement that had been going on for 20 years and, you know, winning some victories and also people on the streets. So this is really when this new white nationalism began to take over institutions. And the NRA works as probably, we probably should really study it closely how it works, because it's actually, it's also how the abortion you know, the so-called pro-life movement works, and it's parallel. You know, that's another relationship there with anti-women, controlling women. It works at extremely grassroots level. They don't spend very much. They don't go and buy senators. Lord knows, you know, Exxon has so much more money. The NRA has about $300 million, which is peanuts. And they mainly use it for simply monitoring Congress. When a bill is coming up, and they have, of course, they have many people that they've helped get elected who keep them informed. And they're like a clearinghouse. They then put this information out. And of course, with the internet, this is even more effective. It used to go out in letters, you know, to people, to membership, that, you know, this Congress, there's someone running for Congress in your district, or this congressman who's in your district, whether Democrat or Republican, is talking about gun control. And they organize at like ordinary people, unpaid, completely unpaid, but not these people just getting signatures on a petition. They write handwritten letters, and they organize locally, and they defeat that person. And that's how, you know, we suddenly saw the Tea Party, so-called, when Obama became president. But that didn't happen just in a day. That's, you know, the same people who are very well organized. And that was John Birch Society's brilliant beginning.
Well, Roxanne, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
My
Good
guest
to
is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, a historian, author, memoirist, and speaker. Her books include Outlaw Woman and the acclaimed An Indigenous People's History of the United States. We've been discussing her newest book, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find out about us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.